Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
My name is Michael DeMoli, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Welcome to episode 78 of The Path to Authenticity. I'm Tom Gentry. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. Episode 78. It's hard to believe. Back in episode 43, I featured an artist named Heather Sundquist Hall, who's a painter in Austin, Texas. And one of the things that I've had in the works since then is I asked Heather to do a painting to depict the path to authenticity, how she envisions it. And if you haven't seen her art, she has this very whimsical, playful style that I love. So she sent me a working drawing of, I guess she's got a couple concepts and she's going to be sending another one, but I asked her to do it. We're going to collaborate on this to commemorate the 100th episode, which is right around the corner at this point. Got 22 to go, which is really hard for me to believe. But I'll put a link in the show notes for that episode and also Heather's website. Check it out. I'm really excited about that project. But this episode features a conversation with a friend and colleague out in Denver named Mike DeMoli. He's a licensed clinical social worker and recently opened a program out there, and he talks about that, what it is, why he did it. And we had a pretty good conversation. I think it's an important conversation, especially pertaining to addiction treatment and the options that exist for people. So anyway, I hope you enjoy it. Michael DeMoli.
Just the product of some bad seeds. Just some guys that grew into weeds.
Tell everybody what you do.
Yeah, so I own and operate an addiction treatment center here in Denver, Colorado. I guess technically Thornton, Colorado, the north side of the metro. And it's a program specifically for opiate addicts to find both like the recovery services and recovery community that they need, as well as like the medical piece and the harm reduction, what we call medication assisted treatment that they need. So we're a unique program here in Colorado. We carry a specific set of licenses that allows us to do like the controlled medication piece for Suboxone, as well as the addiction outpatient treatment here in Colorado. So we are the only program duly licensed for what we do. So, we're brand new. We just opened a few months ago, and we're excited. And it is an exciting time in my life. And I'm just so grateful that I'm able to kind of provide this service to the people in need here in Colorado. And, you know, we're in the midst of this terrible opiate epidemic. You know, it's odd times. We're in the midst of an opiate epidemic as well as a global pandemic.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a service that's really needed, and something that I'm really passionate about.
Yeah. So, but you've also done this type of work for a while, right?
I have. Yes. About 8 years now. I've been working in the field. I've been sober for about 9 years. So ever since I kind of got out of treatment myself, I've sort of been hanging around the field personally and professionally, and this is where my career has taken me so far.
Yeah. Well, so you know, your approach to treatment is unique, and it's also somewhat safe to say it's a little controversial, right? Wouldn't you say?
It is. It is controversial. I would use the word stigmatized.
That's a good word. Yeah.
Yeah.
So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Where to start? You know, there's so much stigma in this field already. You know, there's so much stigma around addiction, substance users. Why would people do that to themselves? Why would people live that kind of life? You know, and I think a lot of it comes from ignorance, and I use that in the most like loving, caring way possible. Like, it's easy to have strong opinions about the things that you don't know. And addiction is something that's not easy to understand. And when you don't understand it, you look at the behaviors, and addicts are known for having very obscene behaviors that don't make sense. And when you can't put that in context of the brain disease that it is, it's easy to have a lot of judgment around that, which builds stigma.
Well, and I would add that, you know, one of the things I've observed over the years, you know, it's an illness that hurts people. I mean, we do wreckage. And so, you know, if you really take a look at it, it's hard, you'd be hard pressed to find someone who hasn't been affected by addiction somehow. And a lot of times, if they've been hurt, they have really strong feelings about it. And because they're hurt and they kind of don't know how to deal with that, they immediately go to judgment. You know,
absolutely.
He's a terrible human being. I can't believe he did that to our father or whatever. You know, it's a painful thing. And then on top of it, you have people who work in the industry who've had their own experience with recovery. And I know, there's just a natural inclination for people to think, I did it this way, so that's the way. And if you're not doing it that way, then you're not going to get better. And that's just kind of absurd, you know?
It is. And it's human nature. And even a lot of us work in the field are highly educated, and we spend our careers focusing on these things. And it's hard to unlearn the things that we learn, and it's hard to keep an open mind to new pathways, to new approaches, because what works for us, we think is going to work for other people. And it's also, it's scary sometimes, right? Like treating the people that we treat, working with this population, seeing the high mortality rate, it's scary. And adapting new approaches to treatment, when the consequences of doing so can be so high for our people, it's a scary thing for a lot of us to do.
Yeah. And this is one of those things, medication assisted treatment.
Yeah.
That people who work in this industry have such strong feelings about it.
Right.
They can't see it clearly oftentimes. So, you know, and I've seen great facilities recognize, you know, there's a need for a different approach that some people would benefit from, and they might be doing it with 1% of their population, but the naysayers out there look at it like they're treating everybody that, you know what I mean? It's just, it's hard for people who are opposed to it to even have the least bit of open-mindedness about it.
It is. It absolutely is. And for good reason. I'm not trying to knock those people. I think a lot of the reason that there's a lot of stigma around MAT treatment is that there's a lot of poor MAT treatment in this country, that it is something that needs to be done well, needs to be done correctly. And a lot of places, a lot of people don't have access to good MAT treatment. And because of that, they can get a stigma when the treatment's not done well. And that's kind of my whole mission statement here. I have a mission statement for my company that we use, but the one that I really want to use is just where it's MAT done right.
Yeah.
You know, that is really my mission here, is to do medication assisted treatment correctly.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I am just a big believer that MAT saves lives.
Yeah.
you know, if we look at any kind of global scale for opiate users in recovery or in early treatment, those who are on MAT are more likely to be alive 3 months, 6 months, a year, 5 years from now than those who aren't. And you can't find recovery if you're not still alive. And at the end of the day, I think that's an important piece to remember.
So can you talk about why you decided to do this?
Well, it was exactly that piece. You know, I'm in recovery from my own opiate addiction, and I've been working in this field from the early days, the opiate epidemic, you know, 10 years ago till now, and working with people of all ages and demographics, and just seeing the need that there is. And as I said before, just working through so many heartbreaks of patients who haven't had the care that they wanted or care that they needed and are no longer with us. Friends, coworkers, colleagues, the number of people who have succumbed to this disease is immense. And I wanted to do my part to change that.
Yeah.
So, and I wanted to bring together, you know, MAT done right of there's two kind of main camps I think of when I think of MAT, when I think of opioid treatment. I think of the medical professionals who come from a very medical model, and it's great. They understand the disease. They understand the brain, usually in ways that I don't. But a physician is generally trained to see solutions to problems, to see improvement. And with that, in MAT, that means medications. And there's some great medications out there, Suboxone, Subutex, Naltrexone, Vivitrol, things that we can talk about later. But then the other camp is the clinical camp, the people like me, the social workers, the counselors, the family therapists, the addiction therapists. And although we understand sometimes the need for pills, we understand the need for therapy to address these core issues that are going on in somebody's life, to look at why is somebody in pain? Why does somebody feel like they need to take painkillers over and over again, despite the consequences it has in their life? And how do we help those people resolve these deeper issues that they can find recovery? And it sounds funny, but these two camps, the medical camp and the clinical camp, there's some settings where they overlap, but in a lot of places, they really don't overlap that much. And a lot of people who are receiving MAT in at least our state here, who are going to their doctor's office and getting Suboxone and taking that medication, and that's helping them. There are a lot of cases they're doing less heroin or they're not doing heroin or pain pills anymore. But the vast majority of them are receiving very little therapy. And vice versa, a lot of people in therapy in our state or in treatment centers aren't receiving MAT. And to our credit, it's improving. There's more access to MAT in that clinical setting. But it really, it is still, most people don't have the access to it that they need.
Well, and you mentioned those two camps. That's why. And, you know, in my experience, probably the best case scenario, especially for a residential treatment facility, is that they have a medical director who's sober.
Yeah.
And a lot of great facilities do.
Yeah.
And it definitely pays off because they get need for the deeper work. They know it's not just about the physical part of it.
Absolutely. A medical director who's either in recovery or really understands the culture, the community, and the needs of somebody in recovery is worth their weight in gold.
Yeah. Yeah. So how long have you been doing this now? Just a few weeks or?
Our treatment center has been open since June 1st. So 6 weeks.
Wow.
Maybe coming across our 7th week.
Yeah. And so how is the COVID-19 thing affecting you? What's happening with that?
It's a trying time for us. It's difficult. There's new challenges that we wouldn't have had a few months ago. And at the same time, I think the service is needed more now than it has ever been before. That means I need to jump through a couple extra hurdles to make this happen. You know, it's what I got to do. But I've seen just about every patient who's walked through my doors in the last 6 or 7 weeks has talked about how much COVID has impacted them and how much it's impacted their drug use. You know, people who had good recovery all of a sudden were stuck at home. They weren't going to work. Their recovery meetings had to close their doors, and they lost their routine. They lost their schedule. They lost their support system. They lost their access to 12-step meetings. And what that happens is a lot of people struggle. And they, when they struggle, they go back to the behaviors that they know, that they're used to. And unfortunately, a lot of those times, they're not good for you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I've, you know, I've had people who I have put in treatment during this time, and then they get out, and it's just nothing like it was when I got, you know, everything has changed so drastically. Yeah. You can't even go to meetings. You know, what do you do if you don't have a laptop or a phone and you can't do Zoom? I mean, there, I think in some ways, like someone like you or I, who's established in recovery and has a routine and has a good support system, you know, we're able to adapt pretty easily and just kind of pivot and do things a little bit differently. But if you're just figuring it out, man, it's got to be really hard. And then what worries me more is that if they get complacent right out of treatment because all those resources aren't available, then when they become available, they're going to feel like they don't need that support, and it's going to lead to a relapse. So it's it's a weird time, man. It really is.
It is. You know, I think of everyone too who was able to function, able to manage. And there's so much secrecy. There's so much, you know, shame, stigma that goes with this that, you know, most people try to hide their addiction. Most people try to keep their addiction going to the best of their ability because they're so terrified of change, rightfully so. And how many of those people have now lost their options to hide their addiction? Right. You know, it's one thing if you work 40, 50 hours a week and you spend time with your friends and et cetera, outside of work. But when you're at home around your family, your loved ones 24/7, you just can't hide what you used to be able to hide. Yeah. And hopefully, you know, maybe that's the blessing is that those people will then also find treatment and recovery sooner than they would have if they were allowed to continue their lifestyles.
I'd like to think that that has happened to some degree. And you know, to my surprise, when this, you know, shutdown began to unfold, I mean, I just thought treatment facilities were going to really have a hard time admitting patients, but it kind of seemed to work the other way around. I mean, they might have gotten a little bit busier.
Yeah. And hopefully, too, people are recognizing that if they're out of the job right now, maybe this is the time to get help.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it removes some other barriers to care for those few that have the privilege to make that happen.
So where'd you grow up?
I grew up in beautiful Youngstown, Ohio.
Youngstown, Ohio.
Do you know where that is?
Where is it in relation to Cleveland?
So it is east, a little southeast of Cleveland. Okay. So it's right between Cleveland and Pittsburgh.
So it's north.
It's north. Yeah. It's on the east side of Ohio, 10, 15 minutes from Pennsylvania.
And then when did you leave there?
So I left there. I came to CU Boulder for college. I was in a phase of my life where I wanted to get as far away from Ohio as I could. And I think I was one of those people that saw the mountains for the first time and followed their calling out here west. So I lived in Boulder for 4 or 5 years, attempted to go to college, and failed that fairly miserably a few times. And through the grace of God and my family system, I found my way into recovery and ended up moving to Prescott, Arizona for treatment, and called that place home for about 4 or 5 years.
Wow, Prescott, huh?
Yes, there's a lot we could say about that town, but it was nothing but good to me.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
I found good people and good fellowship. I found a good job and started me on my career path. And, you know, my early days in recovery there, my early days in 12-step meetings and things like that forged some friendships and some bonds that invaluable to me.
Well, I imagine it's like a lot of communities that have a lot of resources for people in early recovery, and that, you know, if you look at the odds of success, there are going to be a number of people who fail. So if you're not committed, it's really easy to end up with the wrong people and for things to get really bad. So, but if you are, then you have a wealth of resources at your disposal. And, you know, like that's, I grew up in Indiana and came to South Florida, you know, really before it was even, people even really knew it was sort of a hotbed of recovery, but it has really mushroomed over the last 20 plus years. It's been wild to watch it happen, but there are other communities and there's been such a need for it. And the story you tell of like going to college and not succeeding at being a student is so common. That is the story, right? Of young guys going to treatment. If you had to choose one, that's the one that you probably see most often, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There was, the academics of college was not my issue. It wasn't learning how to study. You know, when I left CU Boulder, I, you know, had finished maybe, you know, 2 years worth of credits with, I think I had a glorious 1.9 GPA, 2.0 GPA. And, you know, since I got sober, I've done two master's programs and finished my bachelor's degree. And I've had a 4.0 straight all the way through. And I promise you, I haven't gotten any smarter throughout my years.
Yeah. You're focused.
Yeah, I was focused and I had found something that I enjoyed studying, which makes a big difference.
Now, so to me, one of the things that kind of fascinates me and, you know, being a guy who also got sober really young, you know, my path was I was working full time and going to school part time and had another job part time and going to another school part time and like literally trying to cram everything I could into my life so that I wouldn't have time to drink. And then I rushed through it all so that I would have time to drink. You know, I was trying so hard to control my illness. But, you know, in hindsight, and when I got sober, like there was, you know, the facility I went through, the men's program was full and there was like one other guy in his 20s. Everybody else was 35 plus, you know, my roommate was 67. There was an 80-year-old on the unit. Like it just wasn't like that. And now everyone practically who shows up to treatment is under 30 and a lot of times under 20.
Yeah.
It's just changed a lot. But to me, what I have looked at over the years, one of the things missing parts that I think we don't always look at is that transition into adulthood, or, you know, I think of it, the transition into manhood, because that's really what it was. You know, I wasn't prepared to be an adult. And because I wasn't prepared emotionally to be an adult, I went to substances to change the way I felt, you know, but also there was a lot of fear about, you know, what the hell am I going to do with my life? Can I even do it? You know, I mean, it's really tough to come of age at that time in life. And if we don't have adequate support, I mean, we're pretty bad at it as a culture. We're pretty bad at teaching men how to be men, teaching boys how to be men.
Absolutely. Well, I think of this idea of like mentorship, of like leadership, of like men don't just, we don't just figure it out one day of how to be a man, right?
Right.
We learn. Somebody teaches us. Usually somebody shows us the way. And generally that's supposed to be our fathers. But most of us, you know, when I went to college, I was thousands of miles away from my dad.
Yeah.
And in a young college environment in Boulder, Colorado, you know, who is that father figure? Like, who is those mentors? And I think a lot of us, we have difficulty finding that, or we have difficulty realizing that that is even something that we need.
Yeah.
But in recovery, I definitely found that. I found that very quickly in recovery through my sponsor and, you know, old timers in the meetings and those sorts of influential figures in my life. When I got sober in Arizona, you know, I found my sponsor and he was a young person and that was important to me. I wanted to find a young person who seemed to be enjoying their life, somebody that seemed to be happy, because I wasn't sure if I could do that and be sober.
Right.
And I found that person and he was extremely influential and he's still one of my closest supports. But I also found this group of old Korean War veterans who were so good to me.
Yeah.
And they taught me so many life lessons that somebody my age or my generation couldn't.
Right.
And I'm so grateful for that.
Well, and you know, I think this is one of the real advantages we have as people in recovery, because the way our society is sort of put together, it's not easy to get that. And if you aren't in a healthy family system, if there aren't good male role models in your life, you know, where do you go? And then also you add to that, that we do such a number on men emotionally, like you do not feel. And if you do, there's something wrong with you. So we repress everything, which, you know, so we're not like women have intimate relationships with each other because they're talking to each other about what's going on. And it's like verboten with guys. So we don't do that. And the next thing you know, you're married and 40 years go by. You don't even have any friends. I mean, that's the, so many people experience that, but just the way, and you know, we talked about this in a recent episode, just the way recovery works. I mean, there is built in mentorship, same sex mentorship. And, and we do need other generations of men to, you know, Robert Bly, I don't know if you know about Iron John, the book Iron John, but one of the things he talks about is that young men need the admiration of older men.
Mm.
We need it. And I think about like when I had jobs in high school and there were certain customers who were older guys who would just, or even supervisors, you know, guys who just showed me that admiration. And man, I just basked in it. You know, I mean, it felt so good to have that. And, you know, we need more of all that stuff in our culture. We really do.
And yet we're so separated, right? We are such a generational culture. You know, elderly people do their thing and boomers do their thing and millennials, we do our thing. It, you know, when we live in big cities, maybe it's different in smaller towns or other parts of the country or other parts of the world. I don't know.
And I think probably what you do for a living is relevant too. You know, I can think of back in my days of carpentry work. You know, I was actually an apprentice and I had journeymen who were grooming me and who I was working with. And, you know, you have to put in the time to be a journeyman. So they were older guys, you know? But by and large, I mean, that kind of stuff happens at work, and with work, there are inherent boundaries in the relationships. You know, it's not supposed to be friendship. So there are limitations on that too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love what you said around young men need admiration from older men. I think it's really true. And I had, you know, I talked about those older gentlemen that I knew in Prescott, Arizona, and there's one who was particularly important to me, Arnold Woods. He was a big part of my life and my early recovery, and he's since passed on, but I still think about that sometimes. And you know, I'm at the point now where I feel very like secure in that relationship and what he meant to me. But there's days where I leave work and I say, Arnold would be proud of me today. And that and that carries me.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's just, I think about the guys who've served that purpose for me over the years, and it's I mean, occasionally it's like a client's parents or something like that, you know, but, you know, it's happened in the 12-step community. It's happened in work. And, you know, it's lately, I've been in contact with a high school teacher who was really important to me. And, you know, I just on a lark decided I'm going to call him. You know, and called him Thursday or Friday of last week. And, you know, we didn't miss a beat. It had been probably 20 years since we spoke, but he was one of those guys for me, you know, who showed me admiration, who, you know, I think of him like as a champion for me, like he believed in me and built me up. And that long ago, even to this day, I have felt so good the past few days because of our interactions. It just, it's so nourishing. It really is. And I also, one of the dots I was able to connect was, you know, as a guy who works as a coach, counselor, I mean, you know, I, you know, kind of wear some variable hats, but there's a certain sort of energy that I have towards guys who I'm working with.
Sure.
Which I think you've actually witnessed at times, but you know, like an attitude that I think is loving, but also like, don't be a knucklehead. It's firm too, you know?
Sure.
It's firm too. And it hit me. I was basically doing what that teacher did for me. So the same sort of playful, firm, fun, but serious kind of vibe that I got from him is what I pass along to the guys who I'm working with. You know, it's amazing how that stuff just, it works through us, you know?
I love the context of that. And like in the context of that, like growing up, I think we need those things, right? We need people in our lives to just love us, to admire us, to appreciate us, to just validate who we are. And at the same time, we need those people to also say, but this is acceptable behavior and this isn't.
Right.
This is good. This is okay. This isn't.
Well, and another key lesson in that though is this, because I had love from that guy before he ever chastised me in any way. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that came first.
Right.
And I think that's the way that it really works. And too often as parents or leaders or whatever, you know, we forget how important it is to just give a shit. That has to come first. Like, I care about you. And to establish that, so then when you call somebody on their stuff, they get it. Like, maybe I disagree, but he wouldn't be saying this if he didn't really believe it because he cares about me, you know? Yeah. Yeah, it's, isn't this cool to like go through this stuff in life and then end up where we are, where we get to be there for somebody at the darkest time in their lives and be there to help them change?
Absolutely.
It's such a blessing and an honor, I think. I mean, it's really a privilege to do the kind of work that we do. And I think, I don't like it when people forget that, you know, these are people's lives.
You know, I've, there's a part of my job that is difficult and that is being on call. It's being on call and it's being available to clients and patients when they need it. It's a part of my job that I used to dread, you know, it's like, I want my weekends not to have to be tied to my phone. I don't want to have to stay within a 25-minute radius of work. And it was actually something that happened really early in my career. This this gentleman had a, you know, an episode, and he ended up, you know, cutting his arm and things like that. He went to the emergency room, and, you know, I got to meet him there and spent the night with him when I was on call. And it was sort of like I reframed it then of this blessing of like I got the privilege of being there with this guy on probably one of the darkest days of his life. And was I effective? Did I save his life? You know, I don't think it was any kind of like grander thought of just like, you know, like what a privilege, you know, who really gets to say that? Like, I got to be with somebody on the darkest day of their life. And I got to shed just a little bit of light, a little bit of hope. You know, I got to just love on them when they needed it the most.
Yeah.
That's a special thing.
Yeah. When you were a kid, what did you see yourself doing?
You know, I always kind of knew I'd work in healthcare somewhere. It's kind of the family trade. My dad's a pharmacist. My mom's a nurse. I had a grandfather that was a pediatrician. My brother grew up to be a paramedic. My dad owned a home healthcare company. And I always kind of assumed I'd work somewhere in healthcare or on the business end of healthcare. What that exactly was, I don't know. And I struggled with that for a long time because I'm not somebody that does well doing the same thing day in and day out. Mm-hmm. I definitely need some structure in my life, but I need variety. I need new experiences. I need to be challenged. Mm-hmm. And I was very fearful for a long time of being stuck in a job that was rote and routine. Mm-hmm. And I jokingly say now that I never have a boring day at work. There's always something new going on. There's always a new challenge. There's always new people. There's always something new happening at work. Never a boring day.
Well, and when it's your business, I mean, it could be anything. So it's not like, you know, it's not mundane.
Yeah.
You know?
It is not mundane. That is very true.
Hmm. So what other kinds of, where do you see yourself going with this business? You know, do you have, you know, a plan for next steps, or what do you envision?
I have plans, and I also have dreams and hopes and aspirations. You know, to be honest, I'm trying to focus on the day-to-day right now and iron out our policies and our procedures and our processes and make things flow around here. But I just really believe in this model, and I believe that people need this, that they need really good medical care and access to, you know, these medications that reduce cravings and, you know, increase somebody's life expectancy. And that they also need this deep therapy to resolve everything else that's going on. So, you know, my hope is that as time goes on, that we'll be able to expand. We're just an outpatient program, which means, you know, our patients have to drive to come see us. So I'd like to make it accessible to everyone in Denver, and maybe one day have other offices that way people on the south side of town or people in Colorado Springs can get access to this. And if it's, you know, if this is as effective as I hope it is, and it's, if the community sees it to be as needed as I think, hopefully we can expand and get more and more people access to it. I think the potential of that could be huge from a business perspective of just spreading and giving access to this kind of service.
So what's been the most difficult part of this process for you?
Oh man, there's been so many challenges that I never expected. And
because, you know, the context of this is you left a 9-to-5 to start your own business, right?
I left a 9-to-5 and I had a small private practice, and I was doing well for myself. And as a clinical social worker, I know I was doing a lot better than the industry standard social worker was doing. I've been very focused on remembering and recognizing that this is a marathon that I'm running and not a sprint. It is not a sprint to get a full census, that this is going to be a journey that takes years and years. So I've been focusing a lot on getting 8 hours of sleep at night. I've been focusing a lot on getting my exercise in 4 or 5 days a week. I've been focusing a lot on spending time with people that I love, that I care about, that I can have conversations like this. Because if I lose focus on all that, I just know I'm not going to be able to sustain the workload, the focus that I need for long term. And also, as you know, we're a lean startup here, and I'm providing 90% of the clinical work. I want to be able to show up for my clients and fulfill the mission that I have, which is to do really good care for them.
Mm-hmm. That's great. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, if we don't take care of ourselves, we can't help anyone else.
That's what I preach to my clients, and it's not something I've always done the best job practicing in my personal life, but it is something I strive to do, absolutely.
Mm. So you're liking it out in Colorado. That's the long-term plan. You're going to stick around out there?
I love Colorado. It is. I like the people here. I like the culture. I like the atmosphere. I like the mountains. I've been lucky enough, even though I grew up in Youngstown, I was able to get my family to move out here as well. So my brother and his wife moved a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
My parents just moved a couple years ago. So it very much feels like home for me now.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's tough to be somewhere when you don't have any family around, you know, I've been there. It makes everything a little bit harder, you know?
It does. And definitely as I've gotten older, I've recognized more my appreciation for my family, how much I value them, and how much they help and support me.
So, what do you have to say to the guy out there who can't quit getting high?
Oof. What do I say to them? You know, I think... What I always want to tell people, and I don't know if I always express this well, and it's an odd thing to tell somebody you don't know, but that I care about them.
Yeah.
You know, that there's people out there, maybe they know them, maybe they don't, but that they are cared for, and that there's places that they can go and they can be loved and appreciated and get support. Because I think when you're just out there and you're using, you feel like the only one. You know, You might have friends that you use with, you might have family, but you feel so alone and you feel so isolated.
Mm.
And, you know, like those old timers loved on me when I was getting sober. I just want people to know that they have those kind of, that those supports and those love, it's out there for them.
Yeah.
And with that, you know, kind of like we said before, it's like, you know, that there's other ways to live. Right. Mm-hmm. Like the behavior that they're doing, they don't need to do that. And it's so terrifying. You find something that you think works for you in life, you know, and for a lot of us, that's the drugs and that's the alcohol. It's the opiates. And they, you do that for long enough to the point where, you know, it's no longer working, but the idea of finding a different way to live your life is so scary.
Well, and you touched on before, you know, when you mentioned getting a sponsor who was young and having fun, and, you know, one of my sisters 12-stepped me, and she was sober about a year at the time. I drank with her, you know, I mean, so, you know, she wanted to see her little brother have a better life. You know, she didn't want to watch me die. But also, she experienced enough of recovery to know how happy you could be. And really, that's what I got from her, is you can be so much happier.
Yeah.
If you stop. And that was the first time I ever even thought that was possible. Like I wasn't totally bought in, but she opened my mind to it a little bit. But then one of the key things that happened when I got to treatment is there were all these guys working there who, like, I'd think, man, like, he's pretty cool. Like, he's really funny. Like, I could see myself hanging out with a guy like that.
Yeah.
And before that, I could never see myself hanging out with somebody who didn't drink. I mean, it just seemed so, there's no way I would have. So
isn't it funny, right? It's like the people in recovery are the same people that we used to party with.
Yeah.
They're not different people. their lives are just a little bit more together. They're drinking less, but
they're cool better people. You know, at this point, because they've changed, but you know, I mean, they're the same. I mean, I was on the phone with the client right before I got on here, and you know, he's navigating his relationship with alcohol. You know, I don't know if he has the illness or not. He might not. And you know, one of the things I said to him is, you know, I enjoyed myself. Like I'm not invested in you having an alcohol problem and needing to stop drinking. Like if I could drink all the time, I would. That's now I also like I recently had a guest who she stopped drinking, not because she had a problem with alcohol, but because she wanted to have a deeper, more meaningful quality of life.
Yeah.
And that's the best part to me of recovery, is that everything's so much better. So although, you know, I enjoyed myself, and there's part of me that liked that culture of getting out, mixing it up, going to concerts, being at a bar, all that stuff, I still would not trade it. There's no way I would trade what I have for that. I mean, it's just too good, you know?
It is.
It really is. It affects everything.
And I wish there was some easy way to show that to somebody the day they're getting sober or the day that they're thinking about it.
Isn't that the hard part?
You can go and you can go to meetings and you can find those people and you can listen to the podcasts like this. Yeah. Yeah, but it is a hard concept to understand.
Yeah, so, and hey, you kind of got to feel it. You got to feel it. Yeah,
and it gets worse before it gets better.
Yes,
those first few months, even sometimes first few years for people, are so much worse than their last year of using.
Yeah,
and it takes time before it gets better. And then for a lot of us, I think for me, there's a point where it was just exponential growth. Every day was 10 times better than the day before.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's that patience it takes until you feel better. With opiate addicts, it takes a long time. It does. It's different than some other drugs of choice, you know? I mean, the post-acute withdrawal symptoms just linger for so long.
It takes the brain a long time to heal. Mm-hmm. It takes the brain a long time to learn how to make its own dopamine and serotonin and all that, all those things again. Mm-hmm. And I think at the end of the day, when we talk about MAT, we talk about Suboxone or buprenorphine, you know, that's one piece that it really helps with. It really allows the brain to maintain some level of homeostasis in early recovery. It reduces those cravings. My cravings, my first year of recovery, were terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it was painful. It hurt on a physical level for months and months and months.
Yeah.
And we expect somebody to endure that and go through the therapy work that they need to resolve these issues in their life. We expect them to endure that and make it to meetings, to get out of bed in the morning, to tell their wife that they love them, to show up for their children. You know, of course not. Of course they're going to return to the opiate use, because it is so much easier than enduring that pain and not being able to understand what the benefit is of long-term recovery.
Yeah, and I mean, there's hopelessness. It feels hopeless.
Hopeless, absolutely. It feels terrifying.
So, if you had to go back, you know, to a time in your life when Mike needed to hear something, piece of advice or whatever, when would that have been, and what would you tell him?
Oh man, that's a tough question. I wonder if I would have listened to myself. I was a stubborn person at many times in my life. But I do like this conversation of, you know, if I could have gone back to one of my early days of recovery and just said, hey, 9 years from now, you're going to be living the dream. You're going to be owning your own business and you're going to be helping people. And, you know, you're going to have friends that care about you and family members that love you. You know, if I could just see all this, it would have made those early days so much easier just to know what the payout would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we we have blinders on. We get so locked into the here and now. You know, on the one hand, we need to learn how to be in the moment and make the most of the moment. But on the other hand, we get so fixated on what's going on right now that we don't often have the foresight to imagine just how different life can be in such a short span of time. And, you know, one of the things my first sponsor did with me was he made a God box for me. And, you know, it was a cardboard box that he put together, you know, almost like a piggy bank sort of thing. And he wrote the Serenity Prayer on the front of it, taped it all up, and then gave me a bunch of little slips of paper. And, you know, every time you need to give something to God, write it down, say the prayer, put it in the box, and then go back to that a year or two from now. And, you know, the things that if we go through that practice and do that, the things that we write down end up being so trivial and so relatively meaningless compared to, you know, it's amazing. We just lose sight of that stuff. Things become so, carry so much weight for us in the day to day that we just, you know, our daily struggles just, this is, you know, things work out. That's really what it boils down to. You know, things tend to work out. If you keep trying, you keep showing up. I mean, and that's where, you know, my faith goes ultimately. And that's a real gift of sobriety for me, is that the real hard times, going through something, the real big challenges, I have this ability to not freak out, because the hardest thing I could ever possibly do, I was able to do by the grace of God. You know, I gave it to God. He walked me through it. And like, if I can get through that, nothing's going to stop me. Not problems at a job. You know what I mean? It's a kind of peace that, you know, so much of the world, they just freak out about stuff all the time and carry around so much anxiety. And it's really a gift. It is to be able to live that way and not freak out. And every now and then I got to be reminded, but I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That power of perspective.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I appreciate you doing this, and I hope in some way this can help what you're contributing to the world. And I appreciate that there are people like you who recognize a need to do this right, because, you know, this is the doorway that some people will end up needing to take to recovery. And if all they have is a government funded place where all they do is give you drugs, then, you know, they're probably not going to get better, you know? It's definitely a gap in services in our industry that, at least being done well, you know, like you said, it just, you don't see it very often. And, you know, I also just kind of want to commend you for going out on a limb to do it, because I know it takes courage in the industry that we work in to do something that so many people oppose for their own bullshit reasons or what, you know what I mean? It takes courage to do that. It really does. So honor you for doing that.
No, I appreciate you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that a lot.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate you doing this. I enjoyed the conversation, and, I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Sounds good. Stay in touch, Tom. Yeah.
All right, there you have it. Another episode in the books, Michael DeMolle. You can learn more about Michael by clicking the links in the show notes. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave a voicemail by calling area code 561-247-4757. That's 561-247-4757. You can like the show on Facebook or follow us on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. The show's on Twitter. That's at GentryCast, GENTRYCAST. If you're interested in supporting the show, you can find the show on Patreon, patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. I'm doing a lot of new stuff for patrons right now. I have a limited number of spots for patrons for as little as $1 a month. And I'm beginning to produce some new audio that's only available to listeners who are also patrons. Also some writing that's only available there. So take a look at it. patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. So I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael. Got a couple episodes coming up that I'm really excited about. I'm really excited to do and really excited to share. Lots of good stuff happening. Pretty soon I'll have the new website rolled out, which is looking good, and I feel like it's going to add some value to what I'm doing here and to the whole listener experience. So anyway, I appreciate you checking it out. Thanks for listening. Be good to yourself. Wear a mask. Be socially distant. Look out for each other. Be nice. Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.